wisdom is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Tuesday, May 27th, 2008, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
Toolbox for Sustainable City Living, a do-it-ourselves guide. Part two of our special three-part series, Personal is Political. We'll spend the hour with two radical ecological activists and take your calls.
But I can't help myself, why should I?
This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. In the second part of our three-part series, Personal is Political, we focus today on things that each of us can do to lead lives that are more sustainable and earth-friendly, even if we live in a big city like Los Angeles. Today, more than half the world's population lives and struggles to live in cities. Our lifestyles are wasteful and polluting unless we work to make them otherwise. Facing shortages in food and drinking water, traditional energy sources, and a looming crisis in global climate change, it is more imperative than ever before that ordinary people move toward living life more sustainably on a mass scale if we are to survive as a species. The founding members of the Austin-based Rhizome Collective, Scott Kellogg and Stacey Pellegrew, have written a new book called Toolbox for Sustainable City Living, a Do-It-Ourselves Guide. They join us for the hour today to share their insight and answer your questions as part of our Personal is Political three-part series. The Rhizome Collective is a nonprofit organization based out of a warehouse on the east side of Austin, Texas. The collective runs an educational center for urban sustainability and a center for community organizing. Scott and Stacy have built numerous sustainable systems, including constructed wetlands, rainwater collectors, aquaculture ponds, windmills, passive solar devices, and bioremediation tools. They also run weekend seminars in urban ecological survival skills and have taught workshops all over the world, from the Bronx to East Timor. Scott Kellogg and Stacey Pettigrew's book, A Toolbox for Sustainable City Living, A Do-It-Ourselves Guide, was just published by Southend Press. It is illustrated by Juan Martinez and Beth Ferguson. Scott and Stacey join us on the line this morning. Welcome to Uprising, Scott.
Hello.
Hi, thanks so much for joining us. I know Stacey will be getting on the line in just a moment.
Oh, you're here.
Hi, yes. Thanks so much for joining us. So let's first talk about the definition, your definition of sustainability. It's pretty trendy these days to talk about going green, being sustainable. The big corporations are doing it. It's getting part of the mainstream. But the two of you use the term radical sustainability. What does that mean and how is it different from the more mainstream discussion on sustainability, Scott?
Sure. So do you want me to answer that?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, the term sustainability has been all but entirely co-opted by, like you mentioned, corporations, by multinational organizations, by the sort of more mainstream environmental movement, to this point where it's completely meaningless at this point. I mean, the term in its original definition was to live in such a way that the resources that are available to us now are going to be available to an indefinite number of future human generations. At this point, it's been basically turned into a marketing term. And even worse than that, in the case of multinational organizations, when they use the term sustainable development to be synonymous with promoting the neoliberal economic agenda, we have come up with the term radical sustainability, which is an attempt to take the term and bring it back to its original meaning, but also to emphasize the interconnections between environmental/sustainability and social justice movements, which is something that is commonly neglected in the mainstream sustainability movement. Issues such as prison rights and racial and class and gender issues and global justice issues, these are just as much an integral part of the concept of sustainability as wilderness preservation or coming up with sustainable global food production. If you're truly to have a holistic concept of sustainability, it's important to recognize the inseparability of all these different issues.
Hmm.
So that, in a nutshell, is what radical sustainability is all about.
Now, Stacey, you also critique the notion of natural capitalism, which some people have offered as an alternative to the kind of capitalism that we see today in society.
Yeah, basically, capitalism in and of itself is based upon infinite expansion. And sustainability, for something to be sustainable, it would leave the same number of resources available generations for future generations. And if something is infinitely expanding, it's just not going to add up.
So natural capitalism is not something that you think has the answer in a long term?
Right. Hmm. Because it's still based on the infinite expansion, and the Earth is not infinitely expanding.
Now, your book is organized into five parts: food, water, waste, energy, and something that most of us may not have heard of, bioremediation, which we'll get to later. Let's start with food. Now, when you think of growing one's own food, for example, within a city environment, in order to be more sustainable, you think of farmers markets or community gardens, but you actually don't focus on standard vegetable gardening. Scott, can you tell us why?
Well, that's not in any – that is true. In the book, we talk very little about standard vegetable gardening, and that's not in any way to de-emphasize its importance. The main reason for that is just because it's covered very broadly in a lot of other books, and there's really not that much about urban gardening that is that much different from standard conventional gardening. The main differences between conventional gardening and urban gardening is, one, gaining access to land, which is a major issue in urban environments and sort of a fundamental revolutionary question. And the second is the issue of soil toxicity, which we address in the chapter of bioremediation. So much of the section on food is about sort of less conventional methods of food production that we focus on that you're not going to see written about in too many other books. And those include small-scale sustainable aquaculture, micro-livestock, which means raising chickens and turkeys and small animals that are appropriate for the urban environment. There's a section on cultivation of insects. There's a section on raising fruit trees and perennial crops, as well as mushroom logs as well.
Hmm.
And our whole focus is just that it's in the upcoming decades, as energy prices are increasing dramatically, it's going to be essential to relocalize food production. And it's going to be incredibly important to do that in cities where currently more than 50% of the world's population lives, and that number is growing. We're going to need to be bringing food production back to where people live.
Okay, but micro-livestock and growing chickens in one's own house may cause a lot of people to pause and say, wait a minute, how do I grow chickens in my own sort of, if I live in an apartment in a city, how is that even possible?
Well, you're going to have to look at every space individually and see what sort of resources it has available. Where we are in Austin, Texas, for instance, much of the east side of Austin is made up of small single-family homes, and even the poorest families are living in a small home with a little bit of a yard, and it's just common. It's very common to see families with chickens in their backyards and chickens running through the streets. So in that sort of instance, there's definitely space to have a small space for chickens. In more intensely developed urban areas, we also spend a bit of time up here in Albany, New York, which is built like a lot of high-density East Coast cities. And there's people, even if they have just a small little area behind their apartment building, I've known of people who've raising chickens inside of fire escapes, sometimes on rooftops. You have to be creative with what space is available to you. And even if you don't have access to any sort of space like that, it's also possible to raise them inside of a community garden or perhaps in a vacant lot that your working with neighbors on.
Now, isn't it more sustainable? And I'm assuming that raising chickens is twofold, for eggs and for consumption.
Mm-hmm.
So isn't it more sustainable to be vegetarian than to be a meat eater?
Stacey, you want to?
Stacey?
well, we're not specifically advocating for or against vegetarianism. The statistics are that it takes more protein to grain and to convert into a pound of chicken meat, but again, we're not promoting either thing.
Scott, would you like to add to that?
That it's more, maybe it's more mm-hmm. sustainable to be vegetarian. Is that the question?
I mean, how is raising chickens a sustainable part of a sustainable lifestyle?
Mm-hmm.
Even if you don't eat the chicken, there's still many sustainable things that can
such
go
as?
On with it. And
can you give me some examples?
Do you want to?
Yeah, those can include using them to prepare areas for gardening. Even if you're not actually eating chickens or eating their eggs, you can still benefit greatly from having chickens. And there's something called a chicken tractor, which is essentially a bottomless cage that chickens can be put in and moved around from area to area and used to basically prepare an area for gardening. If you have an area that's sort of weedy, you can put the chickens in there and they can eat all the weeds. They'll eat all the bugs that might happen to be there. They'll be fertilizing it with their poop. And chickens are also constantly scratching at the ground, aerating the soil. So just through the natural processes of the chickens, they can help to prepare an area for gardening. And once they've worked on that area for a while, you can move it over and they can start a new area. So even if you're not a meat eater or an egg eater, there's still a lot that you can benefit from having chickens.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's also move to the issue of fruit and nut trees. I thought this was interesting in your book that you say that fruit and nut trees, Scott, are better suited to urban living than even, say, perhaps vegetable gardening. Why is that?
Well, fruit and nut trees require a high initial investment of energy to get them started. But once they're established, they'll produce food for you year after year with minimal energy inputs on your part required. Unlike annual vegetable crops, which are required to be replanted every year and the soil be tilled back every year as well. Not to say that annual crops aren't important, but ideally to have a balance of perennial and annual crops as well. But the other thing about tree crops is that in cities we have a limited amount of horizontal space to be growing anything in. So we want to be structuring things vertically as possible and ideally growing things up over our heads. In that regard, fruit trees are ideal because they produce the majority of the food crop up vertically over our heads. So it's excellent use of vertical space as well.
And would you suggest that, we talk a lot about planting trees in cities, but a lot of times the trees are usually sort of shade trees, but not necessarily fruit trees. Would you suggest that most of the trees that are planted in cities are fruit trees, should be fruit trees?
If one of the goals is to relocalize food production to produce a good percentage of urban population's food within the limits of the cities, fruit trees are definitely a good way to go about it. It would make a lot of sense to me to plant as many fruit trees as possible, even to create things called edible parks, where I actually know of one.
Edible parks?
Yeah, Asheville, North Carolina, where it's just a park and every tree that is planted in it is a fruit tree.
And people are encouraged to pick the fruit and eat it?
Yeah, and then people can just sort of walk through and collect their breakfast. In Austin, there's a strip of the neighbor's land that borders our property, and we just planted a long strip of fruit trees down there with the idea that you could just sort of walk down the road and collect fruit as you grow.
Now, let's talk about another aspect of the diet. Most nutritionists emphasize the benefits of fish in human diets, but fish that is safe to eat is becoming scarce and quite expensive. Can one really grow one's own fish in a city?
Yeah. We've been in Austin raising fish in a small-scale aquacultural system.
What do you mean by aquaculture?
Aquaculture is the cultivation of aquatic plants and animals for the purpose of creating food, fuel, and fertilizer. It can be done on a scale as simple as just having a tiny little pond in your backyard, something like a kiddie, like a little kiddie pool filled with water, or it can be a much more intensive system that involves pumps and filtration. That really all depends on how much food you want to get out of it. If you're trying to raise a whole bunch of fish in a small space, you need to put a lot more energy into basically processing the waste of those fish. But what makes sustainable aquaculture different than sort of mainstream factory farming aquaculture is that sustainable aquaculture processes its own wastes within itself rather than spitting out toxic fish waste.
So you basically create your own ecosystem.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. And you would use the waste products from the fish as fertilizer for edible plants that you could eat yourself or that you could feed to your fish or that you could feed to micro livestock, for instance. Yeah, so actually in Austin and in Albany, New York, we've been raising tilapia, we've been raising catfish, carp, a number of different fish species.
And your book details how one can actually do this?
Yes, there's diagrams and charts, and actually it's probably one of the largest sections of the book is about how to raise fish and aquatic organisms.
My guests are Scott Kellogg and Stacey Pettigrew. They are co-authors of the book Toolbox for Sustainable City Living, A Do-It-Ourselves Guide. It's part two of our Personal is Political three-part series. And by the way, next on Thursday, we're going to be talking about the economy and how to save your home. So let's continue on the issue of food and water. Actually, water is part two of your book. This is an important issue, especially here in Southern California. We've recently had some rain. How does one harvest rainwater in cities? And Stacey, would you like to take that?
Sure. It's how complicated of a system you want to set up is the boundaries of it and how much water you're looking to catch. But it can be as simple as just putting a 55-gallon barrel under your gutter, or you can purchase a big cistern to catch a lot more water. But pretty much it's just getting the water from your gutters into a collection container, which is called a cistern.
Now, but isn't that water not going to be safe to drink?
It depends what your roof material is, first of all. And it also, so the best would be a slate or a tin, and asphalt shingles would be up among the worst. And then you can also make a thing called a foul flush, which catches, we have diagrams in the book of how to make them, but basically the heavy particulates that are in the air would fall and be caught in the first 20 minutes of rain. And so this, it's kind of a tube that would fill first, and that would fill with the first 20 minutes of rain, and then
that's the water that's not desirable, and then after that it's cleaner.
Yes, and then the rest would go into your cistern.
So how does one, especially for those who do live in homes within cities, how does one make, you know, do you have descriptions of how one makes a rain barrel, for example, and also how one does have sort of water purification systems in one's own home?
Yes, we have descriptions and diagrams of how it's not how to turn a cistern into a rain catch system. We don't have descriptions of how to make your own cistern, but they can be gotten inexpensively or expensively.
Scott, you talk about purifying water in areas that, particularly in cities, using things called floating trash islands. What are those?
Those are floating trash islands are a way of simulating a natural phenomena, which is called a floating island, where sometimes along the bank of a lake, part of the shore will break off, part of the earthy bank will break off and float around in that lake, sometimes for as long as a couple of years. And it develops this huge extensive root network beneath the island that dangles down in the water. And that provides habitat to a number of beneficial organisms, which help to purify their water through their biological processes. So this floating island can float about the lake and kind of act like a kidney to the lake almost, and purifying its water. What we did in Austin was we had a piece of property donated to us that had a pond on it that would fill up with stormwater runoff, which is just water that's laden with all the junk that's in everybody's backyard, whether it's pesticides or fertilizers or gasoline or dog poop or plastic bottles. It would all end up in this pond. And it was very difficult to treat this water. So what we did is we created a floating island that was anchored in the middle of the pond. And it was built out of plastic bottles that we actually collected out of this pond that were floating around like junk in this pond. And we stuffed them into some sort of plastic mesh material, made almost like a giant life ring, if you can imagine that. And then we took water plants and zip-tied them down onto that plastic mesh. And so their roots grew down into the water, and this whole island would float up and down with the water levels. And as you approach it, if you went up to it in a boat or something, you'd see just huge roots hanging down beneath it, and then there would be minnows and all sorts of critters living around the roots. And to some extent, the bacteria living around the roots of these plants were helping to clean this stormwater runoff, which is a common problem in many cities, is just the poor water quality that exists.
And so this is something that can be constructed and can actually purify or at least clean up a little bit of these water systems that we see in cities.
Sure, and this can be done, I mean, if stormwater retention ponds are something common in cities, but it could also be, they all can be placed in rivers or in lakes or in estuaries or even there could be saltwater versions that it could be built. It could be placed offshore.
Is this something that you came up with, or is this a common trick?
It's a design that's used for stormwater remediation on conventionally. But what we did is sort of reverse engineer them, because the ones that are used conventionally use very expensive materials, require a huge amount of engineering and materials, and we figured out a way how to make it out of trash. And that's what makes a lot of the systems described in the book innovative, is not so much that the concept may be entirely original, but it's the context that it's put in, and it's the use and the emphasis of salvaged and recycled materials.
So you don't have to be rich to live sustainably.
Right. Our major design criteria for all these systems in the book is that they're made out of cheap and simple materials so that people who don't have access to a lot of financial resources could realistically copy them and use them in their own communities.
Mm-hmm. And I want to just let listeners know that in a little bit we're going to take a short break and open up our lines for you to call in and ask our guests questions on how you can live more sustainably and make your life more environmentally friendly living in cities. And you can ask them questions that you have about how you can redesign parts of your home or how you can do the kinds of things we've been discussing, including, for example, wastewater recycling, which I'd like to focus on next year. The next part of your book is on waste. That's part three of your book. And Scott, what are the different types of wastewater that are available, and how does one recycle water that one uses at home?
Right. Well, gray water is a term that's used to describe the wastewater from a washing machine, from a shower, from...
Gray water,
mm-hmm. That's right. From your dishwasher, basically everything except your toilet water, mm-hmm. which is called black water, and that's a whole different category. So apart from a little bit of soap and a little bit of dirt, there's really not that much in gray water that makes it all that dirty. And with a bit of filtration, it can be purified to a point where it could be reused for irrigation of crops, of vegetables in the garden, or it can just be allowed to go back into the groundwater. And this is really important because the way wastewater is handled right now is this gray water, which is relatively clean, just goes into a sewer where it's mixed with all the other junk that goes down a drain, which includes toilet water, which includes all sorts of household chemicals and any sort of industrial effluent that gets washed down the sewer as well, where it all ends up in a big sewage treatment plant, and huge amounts of energy have to be used to purify this water. And as energy prices are increasing, this may not be something that's even realistic in the future. So it's going to be essential for people to figure out how to purify their own wastewater, but not only just for that, but just also because it is a resource on your property, particularly if you are collecting rainwater and using that to wash clothes or to wash yourself with. You want to use that resource as many times as possible before you discharge it. So there is something called a constructed wetland that you can build that will purify this wastewater.
Out of an old bathtub.
We built them out of old bathtubs, yeah. We just went around, and any given night in the city, you can scavenge tons of bathtubs that get thrown out, plastic, metal, fiberglass. And what we did is we filled them with gravel and filled them with water plants and plumbed them in such a way so that wastewater going into them moves through the different bathtubs. And in an idea,
so you need more than one bathtub?
What's that, sorry?
You need more than one bathtub?
It depends. It really depends on how much wastewater you're producing and how much you want to be filtering.
Okay.
And in the book, there's actually a formula to calculate how large of a system that you're going to need. They can be done on a very small scale, or they can be done on a very large scale as well. But similarly to the constructed wetland, basically the bacteria that live on the roots of the plants that are growing in the system are going to break down the wastes in the wastewater, while the plants themselves will uptake excess nutrients. So that by the time the wastewater has moved through all these bathtubs and come out the other end, it's been relatively purified.
Hmm. Now, a lot of what you're describing in your book, Scott, sounds like there may be a lot of investment of time and effort initially, but then the benefits are there. Sort of like the more traditional thing that one thinks of composting. I'm sure most of our listeners are familiar with it, and many of them probably already do composting. You have spend a lot of time and effort in setting up your compost bin, but then it's easy. Then it sort of is the gift that keeps giving. Is that the case with most of your projects that you describe?
Those are the ones that I definitely emphasize, the ones that may require a high initial investment to get them started, but in the long run require low maintenance. And I think that's really key because, I mean, we all have pretty busy lives, and we don't want to have to be putting hours and hours and hours of our time each week into just keeping a system going. And if it's got any hope of being implemented on a broad scale, on a broad social scale, they have to be designed in such a way. So, yeah, I mean, similarly to a fruit tree, it takes a high initial investment of energy, but once it is established, it will the yield it provides for you will outweigh the energy inputs that you have to put into it.
Now, part four of your book is about energy, and you talk about biofuels, in particular vegetable oil, but doesn't using biofuels set up a competition for food?
Yeah, and we actually talk about that in the book. And since we've written the book, it's become even more apparent the connection between biofuels and food production. And what we're seeing right now, you know, around the world with the food riots, I mean, biofuels definitely are playing a role in that. And we are not advocating, in no point of the book are we being essentially pro large-scale biofuel production. Our interest is in either the very small-scale, locally produced biofuel production, like, for instance, if somebody grew a small plot of corn and produced a small quantity of oil from that, or in utilizing waste oil, waste vegetable oil, as a fuel source, which is an option that a few resourceful people will be able to take in order to fundamentally save some money and actually be utilizing a waste product to be fueling vehicles or machinery.
What about solar panels? I mean, people who might be remodeling their homes might be thinking about putting solar panels up on their roofs. So what is your position on solar energy?
I consider solar panels to be a useful transitional strategy, is what I consider them to be. They're certainly a lot better than coal or nuclear or oil or any of the energy plans that are being proposed by Bush Cheney right now. But I don't see them as being the sort of magic bullet, the sort of end up to themselves that a lot of people will hold them up to be. And the reason why is that the process of manufacturing solar panels, for one thing, is very expensive. It's very energy intensive as well. It requires a very technically complicated infrastructure, a high level technical expertise to produce them, and then they only have, maybe tops 30-year period of usefulness. And the batteries that you use to store the electricity they produce are even less. So, say there was a community in the global south that was using solar panels. If they were ever to break, or once they had their period of usefulness, and they're as good as garbage at that point, and it's actually, it turns into just a waste problem. The energy solutions that we're promoting are what we call autonomous energy or decentralized energy sources, where the means of extraction, refinement, and distribution of that energy source are put into the hands of the people who are actually using them. So examples of that we have in the book include the very small-scale sustainable use of biofuels, passive solar, which is different from solar panels or active solar, as it's called, because it instead of using electrical components, it uses the sun's radiance directly for heating and for cooking, and small-scale wind power as well are examples of autonomous decentralized energy that we prefer.
Finally, before we go to break, last part of your book is about bioremediation. What exactly does that mean?
Bioremediation is the process of using the natural processes of biological organisms to remediate toxins in urban environment, or not necessarily urban, but just in soil in general. You know, like as we were talking about before about food, apart from gaining access to land, one of the biggest obstacles to growing food in cities is the fact that so many of the soils are contaminated as a result of industrial processes, and you know that's everything from lead to PCBs to hydrocarbons that, you know, if we're eating food that is grown in them or just even through incidental exposure to these chemicals over a lifetime, that can definitely make us sick. So, you know, conventionally what's done to treat the soil contaminants is that huge amounts of soil are excavated and it's subject to energy-intensive processes or a lot of times just thrown in the dump. Communities who don't have access to huge amounts of money or to grants or to the aid of an engineer or without backgrounds in engineering and science aren't going to be able to afford to utilize those options to clean up the soil. So bioremediation, however, is something that's cheap enough and simple enough that people without backgrounds in science and without financial resources can use to take proactive measures to cleaning up the contaminants in the soils.
But it also sounds like something that can be applied on a mass scale and is more sustainable and affordable if it were to be done, say, citywide.
Perhaps. I mean, it may be. I mean, it would certainly be a good option, you know, if city municipalities decided that this is what they were going to actually do implement.
And you have some experience in New Orleans in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. I was there about 3 weeks after Katrina hit, working with a group organization called the Common Ground Collective to establish a community-based bioremediation program. We wanted to give people access to the tools and information that they could use to remediate contaminants that were left by the storm, and not just ones that were left by the storm, that were there prior to the storm as well. I was working with an environmental engineer, and we actually went through the area and took a whole bunch of soil samples to get a sense of what the contaminants that were there and how bad they were. And what we did is we set up a system. We set up a system that produces something called compost tea, which is basically a living culture, liquid culture of beneficial microorganisms that when it's sprayed on soil, those microorganisms can actually break down certain types of contaminants. They'll actually send something like hydrocarbons, for instance. They'll actually eat the carbon of the hydrocarbon and then just release hydrogen
and
as
did
a byproduct.
Did it work?
And can turn materials into safer, more benign components.
Did it work?
Apparently there is post data that was done. I have never seen it, but I've been told that it was successful.
I'm speaking with Scott Kellogg and Stacey Pettigrew, co-authors of Toolbox for Sustainable City Living, a Do-It-Ourselves Guide. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll take your calls. The number to call is 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-KPFK. If you have questions for our guests about how you can transform your lifestyle and aspects of your lifestyle to become more sustainable without having to spend too much money, why it's important also politically, do join us on this hour. It's part two of our Personal is Political series. Again, 818-985-5735 is the number to call. We'll take a short break and we'll be right back after this radical day in history.
The Global Village on 90.7 FM KPFK, Monday through Friday from 10 to noon, spices up your week with music from around the world and around the block. Hosted by Maggie LaPique Mondays. Sabrina Lynn Motley Tuesdays. Yatra Kashah Rais Wednesdays. John Schneider Thursdays. And Sergio Melnichenko Fridays. The Global Village with live musical guests and the latest local concert information. The Global Village on 90.7 FM KPFK, Monday through Friday from 10 to noon after Democracy Now!
You're listening to KPFK, KPFK, KPFK.
People of town.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, May 27th in 1943, President Roosevelt issued an executive order establishing a new Fair Employment Practices Committee, or FEPC, which was supposed to get rid of employment discrimination based on race. During this time, many black Americans faced job discrimination not only from the industries that refused to hire them, but also by industries that restricted them to unskilled jobs and refused them equal pay. Unfortunately, this new committee achieved almost nothing, and Jim Crow employers continued to openly defy it. This was the second FEPC, and some say the first was only set up as a way to prevent the projected March on Washington in the summer of 1941. Now you wonder why people don't trust government-enacted reform. You gotta watch for the hidden agenda. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Welcome back to Uprising. We are on the line with the co-authors of a new book just out by Southend Press, Toolbox for Sustainable City Living, a Do-It-Ourselves Guide. Scott Kellogg and Stacey Pettigrew are also the co-founders of the Rhizome Collective based in Austin, Texas. If we have time, I'd like to ask the two of you about that. But we have a number of folks calling in right now, and I'd like to go first to Alfonso from Carson. Alfonso, welcome to Uprising. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you very much for being there. You know, I owe KPFK so much. You guys are lifesavers. What I like to say to the guest is that I like to be an ambassador for your method of living in the city of Carson. I want to know if I can get your book through writing to you because I don't have access to a PC. And I also, my motivation is to perpetuate your idea on a citywide level here in the city of Carson. So thank you so much. I'll take the information up here.
Thank you. Scott or Stacey? Go ahead. Would you like to, how can listeners get a hold of your book? And also, is this something that can be, just following up from what I asked you earlier, that can be used by even lawmakers and city officials to apply on citywide scales?
Certainly. I mean, it's the focus of the book is certainly on the average citizen, the average person, who isn't content with waiting for municipalities or for governments to begin making the right decisions and to be able to go about the work of making these changes now. But certainly the information in it would be useful to municipalities and to lawmakers as well, certainly applicable to them as well.
We're taking your calls during this hour. Part two of our Personal is Political series. The number to call is 818-985-5735. And also, if you have something that you as a city dweller have found makes your life more sustainable that we haven't discussed on the show today that you'd like to share with the rest of our listeners, please do join us on the air. 818-985-5735 is the number to call. Let's go next to Brooke from Santa Ana. Welcome to Uprising. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. I moved recently from Connecticut, and half the energy in Connecticut is from nuclear power. Most of the energy in France is from nuclear power. And I'm just wondering, does the author, expert, feel that there's a conspiracy of the oil companies to keep nuclear power away from us? Because it is so efficient. In Connecticut, for past 40 years, they've been using nuclear power with no problem.
Hmm. Well, there certainly have been many problems over the years.
Oh, but,
Scott or Stacey?
No, there has. You should check this out. Nuclear power in Connecticut, the price of energy is way low in Connecticut because they used, long ago, Governor Grasso, a woman governor who you probably know of, a very progressive, they built nuclear plants all throughout Connecticut, a number of them, I don't know how many, But the energy is low, low cost, and heating homes, like electricity is very common in Connecticut, and the cost is very low.
Okay.
France had no problems.
Thank you very much, Brooke. Scott?
Yeah, okay, let me say this. Nuclear power is the least sustainable, most centralized, most evil, and I'll say also racist energy power source that there is.
Why racist?
Nuclear power depends on mining uranium, enriched uranium, from the ground, which is a mineral resource. It has to be extracted from the ground and then processed. It has to go through an incredibly energy-intensive process to produce enriched uranium, which can actually be used in nuclear reactors. The lands from which uranium is mined often are the lands of indigenous people, in the American Southwest, for instance, and a lot of Australian Aboriginal land, as well as in a lot of traditional people's lands in China and in India as well.
And what those to do with the waste as well, the nuclear waste.
Yes, and those communities that are near those mining communities suffer disproportionately from diseases, particularly cancers, that result as from them being exposed to the radioactive tailings and to the dust that is produced through the uranium extraction process. There's also, actually in the book, if you read it, there's a whole section that we do about why nuclear power is bad, and I don't know if this is exactly the time to go off on it fully, but I'll say that I am a complete opponent to nuclear power, and I do not advocate it in any form whatsoever.
And we would recommend, if people have questions, the book Nuclear Power is Not the Answer by Helen Caldicott is really wonderful and addresses a lot of these things.
Nuclear Power is Not the Answer by Helen Caldicott. Let's go next to Patty from West Hills. Patty, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I've started a vegetable garden in my backyard, and I want to increase it to the side of my house, but my little dogs have been going to the bathroom there, so how do I cleanse that soil to make it fit for a vegetable garden?
Dog waste in your vegetable garden. Okay, Scott, is there bioremediation to deal with that?
Stacey, what do you think about that?
I would pick up what is there and what is visible, and it's not manure.
I'm mainly concerned about the urine that goes down into the soil. Mm. You know, the rest of it you can pick up. Yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't be overly I wouldn't not build a garden because of it. And I would, if you're really concerned, you can import some dirt, some topsoil and compost and manure and things like that. But I wouldn't not build a garden because of it.
Okay, thank you.
Let's go next to Rudy from Highland Park. Rudy, you're on the air.
Hi. You know, like my garden is set up almost for everything that you've been talking about. I collect my water, and I don't use it to drink, but I use it, save it. When there's no rain, then I water my plants. And also, but the main
thing. And how do you do that, Rudy? Tell our listeners a little bit about
like
how you
said,
collect
the water. Like you said, in the 5-gallon trash cans, and one on each side of my house, it falls perfect right into it, and they overfill every year. And then I just say that if I had more, and I'm going to get more, I'm going to fill them up, maybe get as many as I can, and go, let the first 5 gallons, you said 10 gallons or 20? But besides that, my question is about chickens. I want to raise chickens because of the meat. Not the meat. Maybe I'll have them as pets because I like animals too much. But the question is on snails. How do I get rid of snails? Do the chickens eat them?
Scott or Stacy?
What do you think, Stacy?
Snails are tough. If you can.
Do chickens eat snails?
Do chickens eat snails? There's a really good chance that they would. Do you know?
Chickens. I don't know if I've ever seen chickens eating snails. I know that if you have a problem with slugs, ducks are a very good thing to have because they love to eat slugs. If you ever have a problem with ticks, guinea hens are an excellent bird to have because they're the super predator of insects, and they'll eat deer ticks that are in your yard as well. Snails? I honestly don't know. I don't know if chickens would eat snails because the shell is kind of hard.
Yeah. I've tried putting, you know, they say to put shallow dishes of beer in your garden and to attract the slugs, but that didn't work for me.
Okay. We are speaking with Stacy Pettigrew and Scott Kellogg, co-authors of Toolbox for Sustainable City Living, a do-it-ourselves guide. And this is part two of our Personal is Political series. And if you'd like to join us on the air, the number is 818-985-5735. Let's go next to David from Riverside. David, welcome to Uprising. You're on the air.
Hello. Yes. I have two questions or two issues to raise. The main issue I'm concerned about is how legislation seems to be preventing us from really enacting some fairly good preservation techniques, for instance, use of grey water for irrigation. Mm-hmm. And another issue that I was kind of keen on is trying to set up maybe solar water heaters, and yet there's a lot of funding available for rebates for making solar electricity, but when it comes to solar water heaters, that doesn't seem to be so popular. Can your people comment on that?
Thank you very much, David. Scott, right. Stacey?
I can relate a story. That one thing that we've been working on, Austin, one of our biggest success stories, I feel, is that we've just succeeded in getting a permit to build a composting toilet in the city of Austin. It took us 4 years to get that permit, and that was with the assistance of an environmental engineer who's a good friend of mine who was working for free. There is, with certain systems, particularly with with humanure systems, human manure or composting toilet systems, and with gray water, there is a lot of resistance on the code municipal level to doing these things. And that may be for good reason in some places. If people don't do it correctly, it could certainly be bad. But, you know, one of the most important things that people can be doing is to be getting these, changing the codes, changing municipal codes, which, you know, because these legal barriers that exist, they are what make it so difficult for a lot of these systems to be implemented. Mm. And, I mean, really, people being as busy as they are, and if there's any hope for these systems to be implemented on a broad scale, there has to at least have the obstacles removed, the legal obstacles be removed from them. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we're pleased to announce that we did get the permit to build a composting toilet, so we'll have one of the first composting toilets in the city of Austin. We're going to invite everybody over for a big poop party when it's finished.
And on the issue of citywide policies, and we interviewed recently on Uprising the head of Los Angeles Department of Water and Power and discussed the new plan, because, of course, LA is a growing city that has growing water needs, and Los Angeles will be among the growing number of cities that does, on a citywide scale, recycle water, recycle wastewater in particular, and at least the folks at the LADWP are convinced that the technology exists to do it right these days. And also, the question David asked about solar heaters. In your book, Scott and Stacey, you talk about solar ovens, you know, what exactly is a solar oven and how can you use that?
Stacey, you want to answer that?
Sure. A solar oven, basically what we're talking about are passive solar devices. So they're not a solar panel, which is an active solar. So passive solar just collects and concentrates the heat and uses that.
How does it do that?
By a solar oven would be a box with a glass top to it, with the grill underneath there. And the inside of the box is insulated and then painted black with oven paint. And so as the heat comes in, it stays in.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Maria from Riverside. Maria, you're on the air. Thanks so much for waiting.
Oh, hi.
Can I add one more thing?
Yes, Stacey.
In our book, though, we do have a design for a pretty simple passive solar hot water heater that uses an old refrigerator and old hot water heating tank.
Okay, so David, there's your answer to that. Maria, go ahead.
Yes, I have a wonderful composting pile, and in that pile there are these very large grubs that, you know, spring up every spring. And I toyed with the idea of eating these grubs as a protein source.
Grubs?
Yeah.
Okay.
So anyhow, I went online to look for info as far as, like, how to prepare them, and I didn't really find the answer to the question that I had that was most important to me, which was, you know, how to get rid of the poo in these grubs, or if they're even cleaned out before they're consumed. I did find a lot of info about, you know, people who do eat these, and so I prepared one, but when I cut into it, I just couldn't bring myself to eat it. So.
Okay, Stacy Scott, what do you think about eating grubs?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, basically every culture in the world, except for Western culture, has a tradition of insect eating. I mean, there's a staple of people's diets in many parts of the world, and, you know, there's certainly a cultural taboo of doing it here, which is unfortunate, because, I mean, most bugs are perfectly healthy to eat and actually a very good source of proteins and fats.
And do you talk about that in your book?
We actually do have a section on insect culture.
Mm-hmm.
And we understand that most people are going to be squeamish about actually eating the bugs themselves. But you do have grubs in your garden. You can collect them. If you have chickens, you can feed them to your chickens, who will then use that protein and put it into make an egg out of it, which is something that's more palatable for most Westerners. Or you can feed them to fish is also certainly another option. So we talk about methods of how to actually encourage insect growth. But if you are actually interested in eating them directly, let me recommend two very good books. One is called The Eat a Bug Cookbook, and another is called Man Eating Bugs, which is a sort of an ethnographic history of what is called entomology, or insect-eating traditions around the world. And the Eat a Bug Cookbook, I'm sure, has recipes about how to prepare grubs in it.
Okay. If you're just tuning in near the end of this hour and wondering why we're discussing eating bugs and recycling wastewater and all sorts of issues that we don't usually discuss on Uprising, it's part two of our Personal is Political series. And I want to spend the last couple of minutes with the two of you and ask you, what is the significance what is the importance, rather, of making these sorts of changes in one's lifestyles? Isn't it more important to focus on global political activism rather than individual action? And today, more than ever, why is it more important? Scott or Stacy?
Our philosophy overall is what we call dual power anarchism, which in
can you repeat
is
that? Can you repeat that? What sort of
anarchism? Dual power anarchism.
Dual power anarchism.
Yes. Which is to be working for change within the current system, working for social justice, while we are simultaneously building functioning alternatives to the systems that we oppose. That in a nutshell, is what we were trying to do at the Rhizome Collective, where we were at least trying to make those connections clear by having a space, one roof under which we had so many different organizations working out of. We had the Inside Books Project, was focused on books for prisoners. We had Bikes Across Borders, which is focused on bringing bicycles down to communities in Mexico, independent media, all of those sharing the same space with these demonstration of ecological tools and technologies. So while we were working for bringing about change in the current system, we were still trying to create a system that we could point to and say, this is something that we are in favor of. I mean, one of the common catchphrases of the global justice movement was, another world is possible. And we wanted to actually create a functioning model of what that actually could look like. You know, for every no, we have a yes.
Right.
That's one of my biggest criticisms of the general activist movement, is that they know very much of what they're opposed to, but don't have too many things that they can point to and say that this is something that we actually are in favor of. So I think it's very important to be doing both of those types of work.
Thank you both, Scott and Stacy, for joining us. We're out of time. Scott Kellogg and Stacy Pettigrew, authors of Toolbox for Sustainable City Living, a Do-It-Ourselves Guide. And you should look forward to the fund drive, because we'll be bringing this material back during our upcoming fund drive. For more information, visit rhizomecollective.org. And for Sonali Subversive Thought for the Day, Gloria Anzaldúa once said, I change myself, I change the world. You've been listening to Uprising. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. You can visit our website via kpfk.org or email us at mail@uprisingradio.org. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening.